No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet mortal as his own. That as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurance of their empire over matter. It is possible that the infusoria under the microscope knew the same. No one gave a thought to the older worlds of space as sources of human danger, or thought them only to dismiss the idea that life upon them as impossible or improbable. The opening lines of H.G. Wells' classic, The War of the Worlds. What does this have to do with fraud? Keep listening.
Fire leapt from house to house. Population panicked and ran. This was no disciplined march. It was a stampede, without order and without a goal. It was the beginning of the rout of civilization, of the massacre of mankind. The Earth belonged to the Martians.
Good afternoon or good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you, as always, to my podcast, White Collar Crime and Fraud. I'm your host, Gene Tausk, and today we're going to talk about something which sort of came to me in a, I'd say, a moment of inspiration. I was going to do a podcast, and I'm still going to do a podcast on AI and the future of fraud, but I heard a program this week on a PBS station, which really intrigued me, and it got me to thinking about how certain things, certain events can really make us excited. And I've talked about this before, the excitement factor, and we've talked about the story, how important the story is in creating a fraud, and creating the net, how important creating a story is for a fraudster. But for this podcast, as this title suggests, we'll call this the War of the World effect, where people get so wrapped up in a story, they're willing to drop their guard. Now, once again, we've talked about this before previously with the episode called The Story during the first year of this podcast, and also with a podcast a few podcasts ago about the excitement factor. But this hones in a little bit more on how important the story is and how people can get caught up in the story, even to the most absurd extremes. And to do this, to talk about this, we're going to talk about The War of the Worlds, both the H.G. Wells novel and, more importantly, the hysteria around a program in 1938, which was also repeated several other times. Another radio broadcast, when people should have known better, or you'd think they would have known better anyway, and how this excitement factor, getting so involved in a story, really applies to fraud. Because what amazes me is how people can get caught up in the most absurd series of events, lower their defenses, and of course, this is exactly what a fraudster wants. And we'll connect the two a little bit later as a story, well, towards the end as the podcast continues. But let's talk about what I call the War of the Worlds effect. I'd like to think that everybody knows about the War of the Worlds. It's probably, at least in my opinion, one of the most important, if not the most important, science fiction novels ever written. It was written in 1898 by H.G. Wells, one of the fathers, or I should say, creators of science fiction. Others include Jules Verne, Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. But H.G. Wells is remembered for many of his stories, which created the foundation for modern science fiction. This includes, besides The War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, which was the first story, or one of the first stories, to talk about traveling back and forth in time. The Invisible Man, where, as the title suggests, a person finds out how to become invisible. Wells had other stories as well. The Island of Dr. Moreau, which talked about genetic engineering, although he didn't know what to call it. But it's The War of the Worlds that really helped to cement Wells' popularity. I really don't want to go into it too much, but the story, I think, is known by everyone. The story begins as the narrator says no one had believed in the closing of the 19th century that human affairs are being watched in the timeless worlds of space. And turns out, of course, that the planet Earth is being observed by Martians, fourth planet Mars, and the Martians are preparing an attack towards Earth. They do attack, and as they attack, a cylinder lands, in this case in England. The narrator goes out to see what it's all about. from the cylinder emerges what the narrator calls Martian war machines or Martian tripods, with three-legged vehicles that we would recognize as tanks. The Martians have weapons that we simply have no defenses against, especially in the 19th century. Wells describes a heat ray, which can be described contemporaneously as a laser. It's a ray which can ignite anything in its path. The Martians also have something called black smoke, which we would later recognize as germ warfare or gas warfare. And this gas, poison gas, seeps throughout the countryside and kills everyone. The Martians can dissolve this black smoke with steam jets. And as the story progresses, the Martians continue to invade the Earth. There's really nothing that humanity can do. And towards the end of the story, the Martians are indeed killed, but they're killed because they forgot to notice that the bacteria on Earth was actually lethal to them. What makes the story very interesting, and in my opinion anyway, is that if there's an alien invasion, it seems to me that's the most probable kind of one, where humanity would have no defense against it. And if they're stopped, these aliens are stopped by something they didn't count on, in this case, the bacteria. It's been filmed several times, certainly in 1953. The War of the Worlds was filmed in Hollywood. Gene Barry and Anne Robinson became a very classic science fiction movie. The one I'm most familiar with is the 2005 version with Tom Cruise. I think that's the first one to actually show the tripods. At the 1953 version, they were talking about flying machines. But for what we're going to talk about today is the infamous 1938 broadcast by Orson Welles. And this broadcast panicked America in many ways, although, as we're going to discuss, it wasn't quite as bad as it seems. But Welles, who, for my listeners who know Orson Welles, no relation to H.G. Welles, but Orson Welles was a prolific movie producer, actor, and director, probably one of the greatest producers and directors in American cinema history. His film Citizen Kane is always ranked as, if not the best film in U.S. history, among the top 10. But in 1938, Welles was part of a group called the Mercury Players. They did a lot of radio plays. And in 1938, the Mercury Theater put on the radio play of the War of the Worlds. Now, this occurred in October 30th, 1938. For those of my listeners abroad, in America, we celebrate a holiday called Halloween. It's a fun excuse for kids to dress up, go around and beg for candy from various neighbors. They get candy. For adults, it's an excuse to dress up as well, go to parties and have a lot of fun. But it's kind of a spooky holiday for the kids. That's what it's supposed to be anyway. Anyway, in 1938, Orson Welles and his Mercury Theater Players produced produced The War of the Worlds. It was only an hour-long play. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The play opens up, and by the way, you can listen to it online. The copyright has long since passed. You can listen to it on, I believe it's available on YouTube, but it's out there. It's only about an hour long. But instead of presenting this as a play, as an actual play where the narrator sets up the events as they go along, this was presented as a news broadcast. And what would happen is that the news broadcast opened with a band playing, and then an announcer comes in and says, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, we just need to let you know that there's been some strange series of events, some strange lights on Mars." And then it goes back to the band playing. And then there's another interruption where the announcer says, "Well, there's been a strange cylinder that lands in a strange meteorite, landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey." Obviously, the book War of the Worlds takes place in England, but being in America, Orson Welles decided to place this in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. And just like in the book, the meteorite falls, people gather around it, and then the news broadcaster suddenly announces that something emerges from the cylinder, and this thing fires a heat ray, which destroys many people and cars around the landing site. And this news broadcast continues where suddenly we hear about these cylinders landing everywhere, and the militia is called out, the army is called out, and they're powerless against this. And the news broadcast continues even more, where we have apparently the army here, the army fighting these tripods, and they are called tripods in the play. And there's, just like in the book, the army is helpless against these tripods. And then, as the series goes on, We hear that the tripods are approaching New York, and the radio broadcast ends where somebody is announcing, "Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody there?" 2XL, 2XL calling CQ New York. "Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone there? Anyone?" And then the play ends, and then the play ends with an announcer saying, "You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater on the air in an original dramatization of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. The performance will continue after brief intermission." Now, what's really interesting is that many people actually thought this was an actual invasion, that things were actually happening. And people were calling in saying, "Hey, what's going on?" There was a reaction that people were calling the army bases. People were calling the radio station, wanting to know what was going on. And suddenly the radio announcers suddenly realized that people were taking this seriously. And it actually made the headlines the next day as to people actually believed this. And if you look at the New York Times from October 31st, 1938, you can see the headlines where radio listeners take in war drama as fact. And what's really interesting about this, of course, is, well, there's a number of things that are interesting about it, but the three things I find most interesting are, first of all, it starts off as a news broadcast at 8 p.m. and ends at 9 p.m. In the space of an hour, these Martians land and suddenly they're marching on New York and take over New York, which is pretty amazing even by alien technology standards. So if people would just sit back and think, well, how could this happen in an hour? Well, perhaps it wouldn't be as much fun. The second is, of course, where throughout the this was presented, this, although Welles and the Mercury Theater presented this as a dramatization of, as a actual news broadcast, they did say this is a dramatization of the War of the Worlds. So this isn't something which is completely by surprise. And another thing that surprised me, the third thing that surprised me, is once again, you could read, you could pick up a radio program, just like they used to have TV programs, or I guess they still do. And you could read on the narrative program that 8 o'clock tonight on October 30th, a dramatization of the War of the Worlds will be presented by Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater. So you had all these clues that something, this really couldn't have been a Martian invasion, and yet many people took it seriously. By the way, it's been, this radio broadcast has been studied and restudied many, many times. And the, although there were many panicked people, there were not as many panicked people as originally thought. But still, there are a lot of people out there that took this seriously. Now, there's actually even a movie made about this in the 1970s called The Night That Panicked America, which is kind of interesting, but I digress. Anyway, one of the things that was fascinating about this is that as people were calling into the radio stations or calling into the police, they said they actually could see these tripods and they could see the gas, which, of course, it wasn't out there. It was just a product of people's imagination, but they said they saw it anyway. Anyway, Orson Welles thought the whole thing was pretty funny. Orson Welles was kind of a trickster in this whole thing. And, Orson Welles later embraced this sort of as a personal, as a myth. He took credit for what he thought was a lot, what we thought it was a lot of energy that went into this, and he took credit for the panic that it caused, although initially he said that I didn't have anything to do with it. Orson Welles was a very interesting man. If you ever have a chance to read up on him, I suggested. But anyway, that is one episode. That's what started this phenomenon. Now here's what another episode, which is really interesting as well. And we're going to talk about why people might have panicked during the War of the Worlds as broadcast in 1938. But in 1949, there was a Spanish language version that was produced in Quito, Ecuador. And this one really set off a lot of alarms. Now, interestingly enough, for this broadcast of the War of the Worlds, creators of this broadcast, Leonardo Paez and Eduardo Alcaraz, they worked for Radio Quito in Quito, Ecuador. They had the local newspaper a few days before the broadcast publish false reports about unidentified objects in the skies above Ecuador, and strange sightings of gas on Mars, that sort of thing. But this broadcast really got out of hand. The people actually, there were riots in the city during the podcast. The army was actually called in to put down the actual invasion. The there was a fire that was set at the radio station by outraged people, and people actually died. There was an individual even died because of a heart attack. And one of the creators of this program, Leonardo Paez, actually had to self-exile to Venezuela when this was all over. So this effect was a lot more serious than the 1938 version. So how does this relate to fraud? Well, let's back up for a minute. Oh, and there's one. Well, we'll talk about this in a little bit later. How does this relate to fraud? I've already talked about how the story is so important, how when a fraudster spins a story, it gets a person sucked in. Fraud is nothing. White collar crime is nothing without a story. I've said this before, but I'm going to keep on repeating it. You're not taking a gun out and forcing somebody to give you money. You're not threatening the person, your victim, with harm if they don't give you money. You're enticing that person to give that money over to you freely. And so the story itself is so important. And as we've talked about, the excitement factor, somebody believes they are caught up. If somebody gets caught up in something where their natural impulses of restraint are shut off or toned down, then they become a much more easy target for a fraudster. Now, whether Orson Welles knew this or did not know this, I would suspect that he did know this because he was a very smart individual. When he was planning the War of the Worlds, and when he made this broadcast, what was interesting, and this has been brought up before, would people have fallen for it if this were not so close to World War II? Don't forget, this is October 30th, 1938. World War II would begin less than a year later when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. America was already on a high state of alert because of the events going on in Europe and also because of the events going on in the Pacific with the rise of the Japanese Empire. Americans in general generally were more paranoid at this time than they would have been at other times. And this, of course, led to a situation where Americans might have been more vulnerable. So when Orson Welles had this podcast, when Orson Welles had this radio broadcast and when it went out, and as silly as it may sound, because as I said, in the space of an hour, the Martians land. Not only they arrive from Mars, land, and suddenly start marching on New York, and a rational person just sitting back would say, well, that's impossible. But for America that was hyped up for the possibility of war, whether we like to believe it or not, back in 1938, it seemed that war was pretty imminent, that something was going to happen. And this set the stage for the kind of paranoia that Welles was able to employ as he perpetrated his hoax, if you want to call it that, or perpetrated his broadcast on a public that already had part of its, you might say, part of its neutrality or part of its ability to rationally look at things erased. America at that time was not as laid back as it might have been in an earlier situation. And so Welles was maybe at the right time to create the situation where people actually bought it. Now, how does that explain, for example, the situation in Quito? Well, perhaps the situation there was different. Of course, I don't speak Spanish, so I can't test as to what fully went on there. But once again, keep in mind that this is after World War II in 1949. Perhaps the Ecuadorian populace was also like the New York populace in America, a little bit more tense than they might have been. And so a story about invaders, no matter how far-fetched, a story about alien invaders, no matter how far-fetched, might have seemed a little bit more convincing than it would have been in another time. And also keep in mind as well that, as we discussed in Ecuador, the person who perpetuated this fraud took the time to take newspaper stories printed about strange events. So you might say that a foundation had already been laid when this broadcast was made. And as I said, when I was researching this topic after I got this bolt of inspiration, I couldn't help but wonder, and I think it's been proven out several times and again, a fraudster, as we segue into our fraud area, a good fraudster knows how to take advantage of a current situation. He knows how to take advantage of people's fears, of people's wants, of people's desires. And just like, if you remember a week ago or 2 weeks ago, we had the podcast where we talked about, could fraud be used for noble purposes? And I concluded that it could, using the Normandy invasion as an example. But a fraudster is too harsh a term, but a good radio producer like Orson Welles, who can take, who knew, or I think should have known, or certainly knew about the general paranoia of America. I think he knew very well what he was doing, and I think he had a pretty good idea of what would happen if he made this made that broadcast during that time. Now, did he expect the kind of panic to ensue? I don't think so, but he certainly was happy enough to take advantage of it, and I certainly think that, as later interviews with Orson Welles would show, he was pleased with the results. Orson Welles knew at that time there was a specific radio broadcast he could use, which might create attention, and he did, just like a good, and keep in mind, I don't want to denigrate the memory of Orson Welles. He was a great American producer and director and actor. I'm just using him as an example of taking advantage of a situation and getting people caught up in the excitement. A good fraudster knows the same thing. A good fraudster knows at the right time, people might be more inclined to take advantage of a situation than if they're not. A good example I can think of, and this is a little bit before my time, but during the Cuban Missile Crisis and during the paranoia of the Cold War, a lot of people spent a lot of money on bomb shelters that simply wouldn't have worked even if they were necessary. And there were some instances of fraud occurring then with people selling bogus bomb shelters. But people got caught up in the moment and with their guard down based on current events were willing to fall for something they might not have. And once again, with Orson Welles and later with the podcast, with the broadcast in Ecuador, I'm going to stop saying podcast, but with the broadcast in Ecuador, the foundation had already been laid in that the story had already been there. The Martians invading the Earth. And keep in mind, the War of the Worlds was a well-known science fiction story. And the idea of invaders coming from other planets was pretty much, that groundwork was laid by H.G. Wells when he wrote the book. Authors have speculated, science fiction historians have speculated that maybe if H.G. Wells had had these invaders come from Venus, the story really wouldn't have made that much of an impact. We have a lot more connotations with Mars being the red planet and the planet named after the god of war, etc. So the foundation had already been laid by H.G. Wells. And so when Orson Welles and when Leonardo Paez and Eduardo Alcaraz produced their radio broadcasts, they already had a story that a lot of people, at least inwardly, were willing to examine. And the foundation of it laid that, yes, perhaps there were aliens out there and perhaps they were coming to Earth. And just like a good radio producer or TV producer or internet producer or any kind of mass media entertainment can take advantage of a situation and create a good public entertainment from it, a good fraudster can take advantage of it, of a situation in time, and use it to their advantage. It's something to think of, especially in today's day and age when we have so many competing theories about reality floating around out there. Now, I'd like to move forward a little bit and talk about perhaps, if not the grandchild, then maybe a stepchild of these broadcasts, the War of the Worlds broadcasts. If maybe some of my listeners may remember, I don't know, but in the late 90s, there's a really good movie that was produced and came out called The Blair Witch Project. And what's interesting about The Blair Witch Project, it's used what's called found film footage. Now, The Blair Witch Project was not the first film to use found film footage. That's actually a few other films had done that prior. However, The Blair Witch Project happened at a time when the internet was just getting started, and the movie producers who made this movie for basically a song and made millions off of it. But the premise of The Blair Witch Project is that three student filmmakers created a film or went into the woods of Burkittsville, Maryland to film a supposedly legendary creature called the Blair Witch, and they're never seen again. And then lo and behold, you find the actual cameras that these student filmmakers had, and the footage shows what allegedly happened. Now, of course, it's a fictitious film, but the people who made the Blair Witch Project, the directors and the producers, created a fake internet account and fake internet stories as to the legend of the Blair Witch. And when this film came out, man, it was just amazing. The number of people that went to see it, myself included, I actually had to wait in line and had to get to the next movie because the first one was filled up. And people went to see this. And legends, there was question, is did the Blair Witch actually exist? And there were actually arguments, sometimes even deadly arguments over this. And just like H.G. Wells, just like Orson Welles and the Spanish language producers knew, these directors knew that perhaps if you set the stage for something like this using technology, in this case, the internet, which was new at the time, you might get a result you want. In this case, the result they wanted was a huge hit, a film that was a huge hit. And even today, it's out there. Now, interestingly enough, going back to see the film, it doesn't quite have the same register on the consciousness of people as it did when it came out. We all know that the Blair Witch Project is just a fake. Well, that's too strong a word. It's a story. It's a fictitious story. But during that time, as the internet became more available, and as this technology got out there, the foundation was laid for a fictitious event that actually people thought was real at the time. Now, getting caught up in this new technology, getting caught up in the events of the time, like I said, a good movie producer, a good radio producer, a good storyteller will be able to bring these events and use the technology and events at the time to their advantage. But so will a good fraudster be able to use the events at the time for their advantage as well. And it's something to keep in mind that whenever you see frauds happening, for example, what's going on now with, we hear a lot now, blockchain and cryptocurrency that's in the news a lot, is a lot of these cryptocurrencies and blockchains are discovered as being fraudulent with absolutely no basis whatsoever. We talked about Sam Bankman-Fried a few podcasts ago, and we'll be revisiting that issue again, by the way, in the future podcast. But people like Sam Bankman-Fried are able to take advantage of the idea that perhaps you don't want the government keeping track of your money, and blockchain and cryptocurrency is a way to keep your money safe or in an environment where you can use it without governments catching on. And once again, that lays a lot of the foundation for fraudsters, because this technology is so new, there's an environment that's ripe for it, and people have a lot of questions as to what it actually is, but sometimes they're willing to accept the answers from people normally where they wouldn't accept the answer from. So that's what I call the War of the Worlds effect. When you have these factors, these combination of factors coming into play, when you have the factors of new technology or burgeoning technology, when you have the factor of world events or events going on around you that may lower your guard, and then suddenly somebody presents you with a story that's easy to get sucked in. Maybe I'll trademark that, the War of the Worlds effect. I don't know. But anyway, it's an interesting idea which I played around with, because I think it's important to use this context in discovering what kind of fraud is out there and what kind of fraud can occur. Remember, when I started this podcast, I said as well, the idea of this is not just one dimensional. I'm not just looking at fraud and white collar crime from just the dimension of being a lawyer, being the dimension of being in law enforcement, what have you. I'm looking at all factors, as many factors as I can: psychological, historical, sociological, legal, law enforcement, as the government, that sort of thing. And this fits into a lot of these categories where using the events of the time, using burgeoning technology, and using the hopes and fears of people at this certain time, you create a series of events that a good fraudster knows how to take advantage of. Anyway, as I said, I was hit with a bolt of inspiration this week, which I thought I would apply this to this discussion. Hope you enjoyed it. Next podcast, I'm going to be going back to what I was just to something I was actually researching before this came in the way. We'll talk about that in about 2 weeks. Hope everybody's having a good month of April as it comes to a close, and I will talk to you soon. This is Gene Talsk. Bye-bye.